general physical appearance, feminine attire. Now, what feminine attire is a relative thing. At one time, certain garments that were considered only male are now female. But most men like their wives to dress feminine. There is a trend away from feminine dressing, and there's a time and a place. You know, we're talking about dressing in general. There is three ways to be dressed wrong. You can be underdressed for something, too casual. You can be overdressed. You got the only tuxedo there. Or you can be misdressed. Dressed inappropriately. And there are all kinds of ways to be misdressed. But, for instance, men tend to like to see their wives in skirts and dresses often. They don't mind slacks and pantsuits and things, but there's a time and a place. This takes the matter of taste and sensitivity. Special garments. The men respond to a touch. It's interesting. Women respond to the spoken word more than men realize. Men respond to the touch more than women realize. And a lot of times, in many marriages, they don't realize this, and she's gabbing and he's grabbing, and I'm serious. And sometimes it causes trouble. But women do not realize often how men do respond to the touch, and men don't realize how women often respond to spoken word. Not that it's not mutual, but I'm talking about dominant tendencies. What I call mystery, with modern clothing, there's not much mystery left with women. And men like mystery, and what I call soft femininity. And I'm not going to get into that again because I've already discussed it. But men generally do not like brassy he women. Right? The idea is if you want to be a he woman, go be it somewhere else. Get away from me. And a lot of so-called feminism, I think, is one of the great ironies. Like calling an abortion clinic a birth center. So a lot of feminism, the one thing a lot of modern secular feminism is not, is feminine. I mean, feminine is one thing they're not. Some of them are, but you get some of these feminists, they are certainly misnamed. What they are is he women, I call them. And I've met some he women. And, you know, they're pretty nice guys. I'm just glad I'm not married to one. And what they are, they're he women, are the opposite, the counterpart of sissies. I know some men who are really nice ladies. And I know some women who are nice guys. But I think there ought to be the difference in that. Okay. We're going to have to move along now. And I want to get to the art of being a parent. The art of being a parent. Here's my first principle. This is my contribution to child raising. Did you get to ask my wife much about child raising? Didn't get into that too much. I told her we weren't to that yet. My basic rule in raising children is raise your children so you can like them. That's my contribution to the science of child raising. Well, raise your children so you can like them. I picked up on this when I used to do some counseling. I'll do some counseling of troubled teenagers, and there was a pattern. It was predictable. You can ask a teenager who's on the outs, who's having trouble. You could say to this teenager, "Do your parents love you?" And their response would be immediate. "Oh yes, my parents love me." Kids think that love's kind of built in. Kind of comes with the territory. Then I would ask the question, "Do your parents like you?" And the response would come just as quickly. "Oh no, they don't like me." They don't like my friends. They don't like my hair. They don't like my clothes. They don't like my jokes. They don't like my music. One time they were paying attention to me is when I do something wrong. They just don't like me. Now, I'm not making this up. I recall one time, not too many years ago, I was having a revival meeting, and the guest preacher, and it had nothing to do with the family, it was a revival meeting. And the guest preacher and I were out calling, and he had a 16-year-old boy he was having trouble with. And we were in this home, this young family, and I don't remember how it came up, but it came up that I had a case, we were talking about raising children, and I had mentioned this, and I had said in the home, and again, I don't remember the context, that a lot of parents don't like their kids. And I've met some of their kids, and I don't like them either. But we got back in the car, and this preacher was white as a sheet. I thought he'd gotten sick, and we got to talking, and he said this to me. He said he mentioned this. He said I never thought about it until you said it, but you're right. He said I don't like my son. Well, I'd met his son. He'd have to be nuts to like him. He was obnoxious, arrogant, disobedient, willful, dirty mouth. Listen, let me tell you something. This is one of the most important things I can teach you in this class. Nobody likes an obnoxious snot, even if it's yours. And you know what little obnoxious snots grew up to be? Big obnoxious snots. And if you don't like your kids, they'll know it. And one of the reasons why in my opinion, this is a fundamental reason why why communications break down between parents and teenagers, is that the teenagers sense that their parents don't like them. You see, if you don't like somebody, you cannot hide that. The village idiot knows whether you like him or not. And you cannot hide it. And have you ever noticed it? It's a psychological phenomenon. If somebody doesn't like you, you don't pay one bit of attention to what they say. I mean, if they don't like you, no matter what they say, it's wrong. You're not going to accept it. On the other hand, have you never noticed this? If somebody likes you, and you know they like you, they can tell you anything. Whether you agree or not, you're not going to get mad. You'll tune them in. If they found you like them. Well, listen, the day is going to come when you're going to want your kids, your teenagers, to listen to you. And if they sense that you don't like them, they're not going to listen to you. Now, a lot of teenagers and parents don't like each other. Well, they love each other. They take care of it. They would die for each other, but they just don't like each other. And you cannot like somebody who's not likable. So raise them so you can like them. And then tell them you like them. I'm very serious about that. If your kids know you like them, you have a foundation you can build all kinds of things on. I think I had an interesting experience about you cannot, if somebody likes you, you will listen to them. Let me tell you a story about this. A fellow named Bill Andrews. Bill Andrews is dead now. When I first went to Hamilton, I was a young man. Bill Andrews was his wife had been a Christian for years. And he wouldn't even let a preacher around. He was an ex-military man, ex-truck driver, had tattoos, strong as an ox, and a profane, filthy mouth. But basically a nice guy. He took care of his family, and he was a nice guy. And I liked him. Of course, I grew up with people like that. I used to work on the freight docks. I mean, I worked with men who could cuss in four languages. They could chew you out for 45 minutes and never repeat themselves if they translated. And but anyway, I'd come around to call on Bill, and he wouldn't even let me in the house. He'd talk a little bit, because he didn't like preachers, because two or three preachers had convinced him that they didn't like him. And so I told his wife, I made a point to tell his wife. I said, May is his wife. She's still alive, wonderful lady, and he's remarried now. I said, May. I said, she said, oh, she said, I heard you went by and saw Bill yesterday. I
said, yes.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Bill. Did he say anything to hurt your feelings?
I said, no, sir, I like Bill.
I said, well, he's kind of rough, huh? He said, I grip people like that. I like him. Of course, I knew she was going to tell him, and I did. I like non-Christians.
Do you?
I even like some, I know some atheists I like better. There's some atheists I like a whole lot better than some Christians I know. Anyway, so she told him. I came back the next time. I got to the screen door. He had me in the house drinking coffee. I mean, you know, he found out I liked him. I mean, he'd come right on in. And ended up teaching him in the home, baptized him, and he was faithful to the church for many years. And he died of cancer of the spine some years ago. But I'm convinced that that man would have never been a Christian if somebody hadn't liked him enough. But he would never listen when he let me in the house until he found out I liked him. That's a great lesson. Your kids like you. No one likes an obnoxious snob. If we don't like our children, they will know it. I'm looking at the syllabus now. It is an extreme form. Look at this statement, number 3. Underline this. Learn this. Memorize it. It is an extreme form of child abuse to create a child that other adults cannot like. You talk about child. I think this is worse than beating on a kid in some ways, at least. If other adults don't like your children, let me put it this way. If your child is obnoxious and you can't like him or her, you can just bet your house that other adults aren't going to like them. And if other adults are not going to like them, life is going to be very hard on your children. Ask any school teacher. If you create children that other adults can like. What do I mean? Children who are basically polite, who are honest, who are friendly, who know how to treat adults, who are respectful, who finish what they start, just the basic values. You create children like that, and other adults like them. Life is many times easier for a child like that. They get by in school better. Understand? They can operate in school. If the teachers like them, if they just basically obey and are respectful, if teachers like your kids, they have an easier time in school. Let me say, if you raise kids that are likable, they'll never have to worry about finding a job. There are so many, when they get to be teenagers, so many teenagers are obnoxious snobs, big obnoxious snobs, that you find somebody who's not. Listen, you'll have people calling your house wanting to hire your kids. Your kids will be told things like this. I know exactly what I'm talking about. Look, if you ever need a job, come. When they had a good summer job, I know Aaron had a summer job working in a steakhouse, come home all greasy at night, you know, cooking steaks. And when he quit and went back to school, the employer and the specialist said, look, if you ever need a job, you've got one here. But many kids, they once they're rid of them, they're well rid of them. They want that person around here. I recall that Adam, when he was 11 or 12, he was babysitting this family in our neighborhood who were very active in the Save the Manatee program. And because Adam was only 3 or 4 years older than their boys, but because he was trustworthy, he got opportunities to do things. Every year they would go on, and Aaron did this too. He did this with Aaron. When Adam inherited the job when Aaron got older. But a couple of weekends a year, they would go to these big gatherings where the movie stars, people would come in on the Save the Manatee program. And what they would do is they would take the boys along to babysit their children in the hotel. So, you know, they would have the weekend together. But when it came time, they would go to the banquets where they would just watch in the hotel. For instance, Aaron spent one weekend on the same floor motel with Burt Reynolds and Governor Graham. Said, you know, good opportunity, luxury hotel, fun weekend. But you understand? But you see, if people like your kids and trust them, they'll have opportunities. Doors will open for them. But let me tell you, you raise obnoxious, disobedient, belligerent people, and doors will close. And I think that's child abuse. I know people have a miserable time getting through life because their parents didn't raise them so anybody could like them. And I'll be very honest with you, I don't like all kids. I don't like all of our students. Because you're a student doesn't mean I have to like you. You're not. I'm serious. And I like most of our students, almost all of them. But a couple I don't like. I mean, you'd have to be stupid to like them. Or be like them to like them. I don't like them. I love them. I'd die for them, but I wouldn't go fishing with them. You understand what I'm saying? I'm serious. There are people I'd die for that I wouldn't go fishing with. I don't like them. Now, and children, listen to me, children that no one likes suffer loss of self-image, self-respect. Right then? A kid can only take so much of not being liked, and they lose their self-respect, and they get worse. We must raise, and last of all, in this regard, we must raise children so that God can like them, because they're His. Does God like our children? I want God to like my kids. They're His. I'm raising them for Him. Principle of stewardship I taught you. I have a responsibility to raise my kids that God can like. I know He loves them. Now, here's the biblical warning and mandate. Let's just turn and read these right quick. Tim, turn to Proverbs 10:1. Just turn to Proverbs and read those verses for us. And David Martin, turn to the Colossians. You got a Bible there? Come on, loan Tim a Bible.
Anybody up there have a Bible to look at?
Okay. Exodus 20:12. Carrie, look that up. David, look up the Colossians passage, and Tim's going to read the Proverbs passage for us. Good and loud, Tim, so the recorder here can pick them up. It's in the Old Testament.
Yes, I have it, sir.
Let's just read these without comment. 10:1.
The Proverbs of Solomon: a wise son makes a father glad, but a foolish son is a grief to his mother.
Amen. A wise son makes a father glad. Okay. Proverbs
23:24-25. That's still the Old Testament. The father of the righteous will greatly rejoice, and he who begets a wise son will be glad in him. Let your father and your mother be glad, and let her rejoice who gave birth to you.
29:17.
Correct your son, he will give you comfort, he will also delight your soul.
31:28.
Her children rise up and bless her, her husband also, and he praises her, saying, do you want to keep going?
No, that's okay. And 17:21.
He who begets a fool does so to his sorrow, and the father of the fool has no joy.
Okay, you can stop there. He who begets a fool does what? What does it say?
Has no joy.
He who begets a fool has no joy. Okay, that's Colossians 3:20.
Children, be obedient to your parents in all things, for this is well pleasing to the Lord.
And then the Exodus text, Carrie. There's the biblical warning and the mandate. Very clear, isn't it? Children are, next thing I want to say is, in the syllabus, children are born with disposition, temperament, tendency, relative strengths of will. Each child has his own chemistry. Children, now, one time people deny that, but it's true. Children are born. Any of you have had more than one child probably know this. Children are born different. They are not absolutely blank slates. They're born with different temperaments, tendencies, relative strengths of will, and so forth. And I'm going to talk about that when we talk about why children challenge the authority of their parents. But they're different. All four of our children were different when they were born. You could tell on the way home from the hospital if they were different. I point to the foolishness of assuming that all children can be treated with perfect equality. That's an important thing to teach you. You cannot treat children equally because children are not equal. Now, equal benefits, but I'm talking about you cannot treat them the same I have seen parents raise, I know one man who's a friend of mine, has raised four children, and he felt obligated to raise them all the same. Two of them turned out great, and two of them not worth shooting. Because what one needed, the other one didn't need. Now, that may be not the only reason for that. Yes.
Something that I've been asking myself, you know, because I would like a little girl more than anything, you know, because I had a kid and thing. And I have been concerned about my own feeling, but I mean, the little boy comes first. Not that I would, but I think that I would show, I'm worried that I would like to show favoritism.
Okay.
To my girl.
Let me answer your question. When you go through the actual experience, when you get married and your wife has that first baby, and especially if you're in the labor room, and you go through all those hours of labor and all that, and when it finally comes, the last thing you're going to think about is the sex of the child. All you're going to want is to get over with. You'll be so glad when the baby comes, get over with it, you'll be tickled to death from then on, and it won't make any difference to you. Isn't that the truth? Now, later on, you may reflect later on, but no, that will not happen. That will not happen.
Because, I mean, I look at myself and I say, no, I couldn't do that.
Little girls, let me say this to you, that daddies, I can't speak for women, but men have a different feelings for little boys. Well, some feelings are the same, but that there are feelings that little girls, the daughters excite in a father, which are different than the son. That is, by the way, men are closer to their daughters than they are to their sons, unless they're very careful. They're naturally closer to daughters than they are to sons. They have to work at it. How shall I say that? Most of the time, a man has to work harder at being closer to his son than he does to his daughter. I did. It's a natural temper. And little girls respond to their fathers quicker than little boys do. And little boys respond to their mothers. You know that? Very true. I'll tell you a story. This is absolutely true. Not that I lie other times. We had our two daughters first, and I can remember many times my wife would be home with the baby with the little girls all day, and I'd come home the knight in shining armor, you know, and they'd run and fuss over daddy. Daddy be my horsey. That was Leslie. But at night, you'd be in bed asleep, and you hear the pitter-patter of little feet come in. And daddy, I had a bad dream. Or come up a storm, the daddy's just, can I get in bed? And I get scared. And it always come to my side of the bed. Never once went to the other side of the bed. And little, you know, little scared. So I look, okay, you're not letting me there for a few minutes. You know, you okay now? Yeah, go back to bed. I go back to bed, be fine. And I felt like, you know, king of the hill. When the little boys came along, and they never once came to my side of the bed. And they either have a bad dream or get scared, or come pattern in. They go to Linda, to my wife's side, and say, Mommy, can I get in bed with you? I had a bad dream. No, just natural. And I've had others tell me the same thing. And, you know, they never thought about it. It's just that's they were drawn to her, and then the little girls were drawn to me. Now, but the pride, that the feelings a man has for his daughter, I mean, the guys, let me tell you, it takes a strong-willed father not to completely melt in the presence of his baby girls. To really be as strong as he has to be sometimes. But the pride that a man has in sons, most men want sons. And it's a little different feelings. I've had both. I remember, of course, I'd already had two daughters when my first son came along. Here's something else that's funny. A baby assumes a sex in the mother's mind while it's in the womb, whether it's the right one or not. And my wife, we had our two daughters, and I was really ready for a son. I was raring for a son, you know. But my wife was a third daughter. And in her mind, our oldest son, Aaron, all the time she was carrying him, she was a girl. She thought pink. She never thought blue. In her mind, that was her third daughter. She had a trio. You know, my wife sang in a trio. That was a girl. And when it came out male, my wife went into a depression. The like of which I've never seen, and not because she was shocked, not that she didn't want a son, she's tickled it, but the idea, because she was subconsciously, I guess, she thought female and was totally shocked that it was a boy. And what made it worse, what made her depression worse was, she was going around saying, I don't know how to take care of a boy. This is the postpartum delusion when you go through the child. I don't know how to take care of a boy. What am I doing with an old boy? And here I'm at like a complete fool. I got a son. I got a son. You know, I'm kissing the nurses, running up down the hall, throwing confetti. You know, and I'm just really celebrating. And the higher I went, the lower she got. And, you know, you're happy. Of course you're happy. You got your son. Oh, my God. You know. And then, of course, when the chemistry, a lot of that's chemistry. A woman's chemistry. I mean, that and nothing else. And once, you know, she got settled down, it was great. But it was hilarious. Like I had to really calm myself down. I'd go in there, you know, I'd go down the hall and see my son, you know, and I was rejoicing in the, you know, looking through the glass. But when I went in her room, I had to calm down. You know, it's a good sir. Now, yes, well, he's doing fine. And then, for a day or so, I'd be very careful. I didn't act too happy, but she really had to lose. Yes.
Why do you think, for another class, I was doing a study on the importance of fathering, and I came up with this statistic that 3 to 1 prefer the father, prefer the little boy. Why do you think that is? Is it because of the later on, you know, they can, you know, play football, baseball, musicians and stuff? Or why is there a difference like that if a father can get close to the daughter?
I don't know. You asked the wrong person.
That's a good question.
But little girls, really, I'm saying is this, if a man destroys the affection his little daughters have for him, he has to work at it. Because he's got, he starts out ahead of the game. Now, boys is different. Well, anyway, look at my statement here. Within the framework of genetic tendency and temperament, within that framework, we create a person. Nurture outvotes nature. You got that? Nurture outvotes nature. I don't care what you start with. Listen to me. We talk about children are born strong-willed and compliant, and some children are high-strung and others are not. Children are born with these different temperaments, but the fact, unless you've got some kind of defect, which often happens, there's all the things being equal. I don't care what you start out with. That's what I'm teaching. I don't care what you start out with. You can create a child that you can like. That's worth something. No matter what you start with. It just takes more work. And it takes different kind of work for some than others. I point to the inadequacy of the Darwinian-Freudian paradigm. One of the reasons why much modern secular psychology, especially child psychology, doesn't work is that it is Freudian, and Freud based his work on Darwin, and Darwin was wrong. People are not, and I give you the two ways why Freudianism, Darwinism is wrong. Number one, people are more complex than the theory of evolution permits them to be. That includes children. And secondly, people are not naturally good as secular evolutionism wants them to be and humanist doctrine declares them to be. Let me tell you something. These little children are not, they are born naturally neutral, but sin does its deadly work early on, and it's a sentimental idea that children are naturally holy, naturally good. You heard this. Well, children never, you know, little children never lie. They're so honest. Whoever said that never had kids. The kids will lie every chance they get if it keeps them out of trouble. And often little children, you understand, don't you, that small children cannot tell the difference between that which is imaginary and that which is real at all times. I've seen some very foolish parents spank it. Gets this little four-year-old comes in and says, I saw a tiger in the backyard. And the mother says, now, and he's giving this big lecture on truth versus falsehood. The child comes in 2 hours later and she says, well, did you see a tiger? Yeah, he's still there. And she gives him a spanking for lying. He isn't lying. He's got an imagination. Understand? Little children cannot distinguish at all times between what is imaginary and what's real. That's not, that line, while it's a very fixed line for adults, it is not. It's a very wavy line for children. Sometimes it isn't there at all. By the way, that's why I see no harm whatever in playing the Santa Claus game. The idea that, I've had people lecture me on this, If you tell your children there's a Santa Claus, they'll never believe a word you say when they grow up. That's hogwash. Utterly hogwash. During those early years, the distinction between what's imaginary and what's real is so fuzzy anyway. It's a harmless child's game. And when they get old enough, when their system develops and they can handle this, they understand very clearly. Every one of them, when they get old enough to begin to talk about being Christians, I would just say to each one of my children, you understand that when we talk about Jesus, that's real, but Santa Claus was just a game. They understand that perfectly. They understand that. You know, they never felt they were lied to. In fact, every child, the last year that they believe in Santa Claus, they are agnostics anyway. They don't really believe. They pretend to believe that last year anyway, just to play the game. Understand? They've already developed this awareness of what's a game and what isn't. But children are not naturally good. Children need control. Next, parents must not exist for the children. Remember I talked about this when I talked about romance in marriage preserves the primary role of the husband and wife. That is, a husband and wife, not parent. That's the secondary role. Well, children, you must not... It is sentimental nonsense to exist for the children. It's an unreasonable burden to place on children, one they do not want. And secondly, children must be brought up to understand the reality of earned privilege. Yes, Renee.
I have a question back with the if the child does not know between real and what's not real, then how can some children get so upset and cry when they find out their grandpa is not real?
I don't know if they did.
I have a cousin, and she found out he wasn't real, and she was devastated.
Well, I don't know how it was handled, but I've never known it to be a problem.
How old was she when she found out? Probably was at the reached that maturity level where she could distinguish, and she was still...
Yeah, if you don't tell them... By the way, every one of our children, when we told them there wasn't any Santa Claus, they already knew, is what I'm saying. But maybe they were told too early or something. I don't know.
She figured out on it.
Well, I can understand that. I know when I found out there wasn't any Santa Claus, I was so upset. I didn't shave for several days. Joke. Now, listen. We do not exist for the children. Children must be brought up to understand the reality of earned privilege. What I'm saying is this. I have seen couples, especially even in the church, they're active in the church until the first child comes along. And then all of a sudden, they shut down their lives, and everything revolves around the children. They don't go out anymore. Why? Well, the babies, they don't like it. And on and on. It is nonsense. The rule, here's what I teach you students. When you have your kid, we've had four kids. I know what I'm talking about. Live your life. Take them along for the ride. They'll enjoy it better. Their day will come. You get this idea of children, the principle of earned privilege. Some modern psychologists say, well, parents should never do anything that they don't expect the child to do. For instance, you can't holler at your children unless you're going to let them holler at you. Nonsense. I'm the father. I'll holler all I want to. I've earned the right to holler. I know how to holler. I know what to holler about. You keep your mouth shut. Get and listen. When you get to be a father, you can holler. When you earn the privilege to holler, then you holler. Until then, you used to be quiet and listen to me holler. And the idea, when you spank a child, you'll teach him violence. That's nonsense. By the way, if that's true, then the natural phenomenon of pain is immoral. That is, a child touches a hot stove, that small amount of pain preserves his life, keeps him from burning himself to death in later years. It doesn't make him a pyromaniac. Understand? He falls down and scratches his knee. He learns to be more careful. He doesn't become a sadist. And when you spank a child, I'm not talking about abusing, but you spank a child's buns, you're not going to make him a violent child abuser. If you do abuse him, you're going to teach him that a little bit of pain can stop him from a whole lot more pain later on. I'd better spank a child for running out in the street and have his buns glow for an hour or two than to have him run out and get run over by a truck and bury him. You understand? A little bit of pain on the buns is worse than getting hit by a car. I mean, it's better than getting hit by a car. It's worse, a little bit of... Well, you understand what I'm teaching. That's privilege. Your turn will come, kid. Why can't I go? Because you're a kid. Why can't I do that? Your day will come. You understand? That is a healthy... that is reality. The principle of earned privilege. And many kids are raised by weak-minded parents, and they get the privileges, listen, they get all the privileges simply because they exist, and the parents exist for the children, and they never learn the valuable lesson of earned privilege. I always feel very badly when I give true and false tests. Every time I give a true and false test, I get half a dozen students who try to rewrite the questions. And I don't even read what students write on true and false questions. I grade them. And why? Because they see, I've earned the privilege to give the test. You want to write a test? You do what it takes to become a professor, and you can write a test. I'm serious. But in the meantime, you take my test. You have not earned the privilege of rewriting my exams. That's a small, I'm just joking with you. But it's a very profound principle of children. Well, if Daddy can do it, I can do it. Nonsense. Nonsense. There's more nonsense in modern child psych. I read the books. Dr. Spock was the big thing when he was Freudian. I read Dr. Spock, and I knew, and I was young and stupid, and I didn't know all this stuff, but I knew he was wrong. I read Dr. Spock, and I read back and through that book as far as I could. And interesting, he turned out he was wrong. He admitted his kids turned out rotten. Because most of what he taught was Freudian and Darwinian, and it was nonsense. And kids don't want to be the center of attention. I'm not saying we don't do things for our children. They join Little League. I know parents who don't do anything but run their kids to ballet and Little League and here and there, and they don't have a life of their own. They're living for the children. And the children usually grow up to be self-centered, spoiled brats. So you can give a child too much attention. You certainly can. And they don't like that. Then I mentioned the absolute requirement of a role model. Not perfection, but a role model. Children are absolutists. You know that? Children think in terms of black and white, either or. We must be role models. Listen. What you are, your children will know what you are. You cannot fool your kids. And I'll be very honest with you, one of the many motives, not my primary motive, but one of the many motives for living a straight life. You know what the straight life is? Where you pay your bills and keep your word, and you're not a coward, and you fulfill your responsibilities, and you make the mortgage payments, and you live for the you're faithful to your wife. Just a straight life. One of the real motives for that is the kids are watching. And listen, it doesn't matter what you say to your kids; they'll see you. They'll watch you. Well, you don't have to say anything. I remember one time. Kids, and this has a profound effect on kids who are raised in our modern culture. Remember one time I went out, I took Adam shopping up at the Bash shoe outlet somewhere, and we bought a couple of pairs of shoes, and I put on my credit card, and on the way out, I was just kind of looking at it, and I noticed that she had undercharged me by about $20. This young girl. And she made it out. And I showed it to Adam. And I said, look what she did. And I turned around and I said, well, we're going to go back. And he said, where are you going? I said, we're going to take it back. And he didn't say much. And I took it back and I took the girl. And I showed her. I said, you need to make this out again. I said, you're going to undercharge me $20. And she was just flabbergasted. And here's Adam sitting here watching. Didn't say a word. And she said, well, she said, I really appreciate you bringing this back. And I said to her, and I knew, I said it for him. I said, look, I came to buy shoes, I didn't come to steal them. And he talked about that, he just had a profound effect on him. You understand? He didn't say anything then, but later on, I heard him talk about it. And I didn't think about it at the moment. I thought it was just not a big thing, but I did, later on I realized it had a profound effect on it. Listen, our kids are watching us. Our kids are watching us. Be a role model. Secondly, the problems created by the single parent family, when the only, usually, and the tragedy is usually the single parent is the woman, and these principles apply, have to be applied as insofar as they can be applied. You understand I'm teaching about, mainly I'm speaking in terms of the dual parent home, although that's becoming the minority arrangement. There's only one parent. The single parent has to apply these principles as best the single parent can. The problems created by the matriarchal home I've already mentioned, that is, children raised in a home where the mother was in charge have trouble being biblical parents, have to learn how to do it very often. The parent-child relationship, last of all, is determinative in the child's emerging relationship with God. Listen, if your children do not have a good relationship with you, they are going to have a very hard time having a good relationship with God. Because when they first begin to think of our Father in heaven, they think in terms of our Father on earth. Because what Father means to them is what's in it, is the connotations of that word that they picked up from the home. Next, the principle of unlimited grace and mercy. And I speak here of the distinction between acceptance and approval. It is one thing to accept your children unconditionally. It is something else to approve of all that they do. And many parents cannot make that distinction, and they think that they have to approve everything or nothing, and they cannot, and if they do not approve, they cannot accept. Do you understand that difference? That is, our children do not, it is an unreasonable, false, wrong expectation to put up to say to our children, you must earn your acceptance. Children do not have to earn their acceptance. They're born into the family. They are accepted. Now, they often have to earn approval. And approval has to, and that's natural. That's good. You see the difference? Remember what I told LeAngelo? Let me give you a difference between acceptance and approval. It's a question. I read this. Let me ask you, I'll give you a quiz. Here's two situations. Situation A, father has a daughter who's going out, and she's going to start dating. Father A says to his daughter, you're going to go out and date, and you're going to be out with the boys. If you get pregnant, you just keep going. I'm not going to put your mother through this. You know how we feel about this. We're not going to have it. Father B says to his daughter, look, honey, you know what our moral standards are, you know what we've taught you. If you go out and get in trouble, you get pregnant, you come home, we'll work it out. No matter what you do, you come home, we'll work it out together. Question is, Father A or Father B, whose daughter is more likely to get pregnant?
Father A.
And the experts say that's true. Now, when I first taught this, I had a student in the class who went home and discussed it with his father, and came back and very vehemently disagreed with me, because in this father's mind there was no distinction between approval and acceptance. He said, "You can say to a child, look, I may not approve of what you do, but I always accept you. You're still my child." Understand? And children sense that it is the reasonable, normal thing for them to have to earn the approval of their parents. And parents who give unconditional approval at all times are simply weak-minded. But children also sense that something's wrong if they have to earn the acceptance of their parents. Principle unlimited. This is the principle. Listen, kid, I don't care what happens. You come home. We'll work it out together. That's acceptance. Now, I may spank your bottom. You come and tell me. We'll work it out. I may penalize you. If your kid comes home, he's done something wrong. Children who don't feel accepted don't tell. They get and a gap is created, a gulf is created between parent and child. Don't you know that some of you can, that I don't want to see any show of hands, but some of you, I'm just guessing on the odds, some of you had parents, that kind of relationship with your parents. If you did something wrong, the first thing you did when you went home and told them, I mean, you felt, wanted to get it off your chest. You got in trouble, you really pulled a boner. You went home and told your parents. First thing you did, why? Because you knew you were accepted. Even if you're going to get in trouble. Others, if you did something wrong, the parents were the last ones you would tell. You would conceal it and hide it. Why? Because somehow you may have felt that if they found out about this, they wouldn't accept you. That's very bad. Now, you understand the difference? Any questions on that? That's a fundamental principle of raising children. Children have a right to be accepted. Approval is another thing. In fact, the Bible teaches that punishment is a part of acceptance. God has no children he does not discipline. You understand? Disciplining shows acceptance. Why do I have to spank you? Because you're mine.
Does the distinction between spanking the child,
principle of prophetic grace, and prophetic grace, I introduced this when we talked about the theoretical basis of marriage. Prophetic grace is giving our children credit for being people of stature ahead of time. You and my wife and I call this, you are special. My wife taught me this. You are special. That is, if you teach children from the very youngest age that they are not ordinary children. Now, we have a theological basis for this. Number one is the Bible teaches that Christians are peculiar people. We are not to be like the world. And secondly, we are to operate on the principle of grace, to give credit where credit is not deserved. But prophetic grace is you give kids credit ahead of time. If you give a kid credit, whatever you give a kid credit for being, he usually becomes. If it's negative and bad, they'll become that too. I know kids who are rottener than they really want to be just because they're trying to make their calling and election sure. They've had some parent who told them they were rotten, so they're going to be rotten. Why do you have to be so bad? Well, they'll sort of like a self-fulfilling prophecy. Another reason why this principle of you are special works is that, and this will sound arrogant, and I apologize for that ahead of time, but my wife and I have always agreed that we're not the least bit interested in raising average children. One thing, if you look at the average lately, I mean, to be average today takes nothing. You can be the average by just showing up. A retarded chimpanzee can be average today. A couple of retarded chimpanzees be above average in some circles, but one of my fondest memories is to see my wife with a toddler bouncing on her lap, saying to this toddler, "Now, whatever you're going to be, it's going to be very special. You're a very unusual child." And children grow up with this concept that the ordinary rules do not apply to them. That is, moral rules. We found out later on that it protects children from negative peer pressure. Now, all peer pressure isn't bad. Some peer pressure is good, but a good bit of it's negative. We didn't plan it that way, but it just worked out that way. That is, if children understand that the ordinary rules of society don't apply, moral rules of society don't apply to them, it insulates them. They don't really care what the secular crowd thinks. Why? It never occurs to them that it applies, that has anything to do with them. Why? Well, that's for ordinary people. And you can use this as the foundation for teaching when they get older. You see, if you ever notice, teenagers don't like lectures, don't like sermons. I notice this. Well, you can preach this. I preach some of my best sermons to my teenagers at home. And I just noticed this after about the third word I'm talking to myself. Teenagers are like this. They do not like to be preached to. But they will listen if you'll tell them what's smart, and they'll listen if you'll tell them what's quality. And one of the rules at our house is that we raise thoroughbreds around here. If you want to be cheap, you go live somewhere else. And you raise young people who expect much of themselves, because they have this concept, that they are not ordinary, and that they have standards to live up to. And I've even spanked them for that reason. I said, "Look, I spanked them for being cheap." And when they go out and begin to date, and they run into all the pressures that they're in high schools. We've always had our kids in public high schools. They understand. You say, "Look, now, don't forget who you are." This is, for instance, what do you do about drinking? You can get into these intricate arguments in the Bible: can you drink or not drink? What I always teach at our house is that we don't drink because we're not cheap. Any stupid guy can stick alcohol down his gut and think he's three kinds of hot stuff. That takes nothing. Ordinary people talk. We don't use language like this. Why? That's cheap and ordinary. That's trashy. We don't operate that way. Now, they already know the morals. Understand? We've already taught them the right and wrong, the moral precepts. But when it comes right down on a day-by-day basis, when teenagers have to face what teenagers have to face, and most parents don't have any idea what teenagers face in schools, especially junior high school. And you can say to a kid, "Look, you got to decide whether you're going to be an eagle or a sparrow. You can fly high above the crowd, or you can flitter around with everybody else going cheap, cheap, cheap." And we don't like cheap. You understand? And you understand? And kids don't want to be trashy. They don't want to be cheap. They don't want to be third rate. And they'll listen to you. But you have to lay the foundation of this concept that you're special. We don't do that because we're not cheap. We just I remember when Aaron I talk about him because he's not here. Next year he'll be here, so I can't talk about him. But Aaron had a friend, Bill, is going to be here next year. Bill. Oh, Bill. Let me tell you something about Bill. Hilberg, his name. Bill was a throwaway kid. And would have been. And Aaron, they became friends in high school, in junior high school. And Bill, and Aaron converted Bill, went to the Lord. Now Bill's going to come to Bible college. But Aaron had some friends who were kind of the in crowd. And Aaron was a part of that crowd. You know, the kids at school who teachers give responsibility to and that kind of thing. And as they began to get into the high school years, a couple of these boys sent word to Aaron in a very subtle way, as kids can do, "Look, we want you to be a part of our crowd, but we don't want Bill. You fit in, he doesn't. So you can come and be a part of us, but you can't bring Bill." And they got that message across to him. And he'd already made up his mind, but he came and talked to me about it. And he was furious. And he said, and I said to him, "Well, I appreciate your decision. You know, don't you?" I said that only trashy people operate that way. We don't operate that way in this house. If you've got a friend, he's your friend. You stick to your friends. We don't judge people on this other basis. And if you have to give up a friend to be a friend of these guys, then that's just some cheap kind of third-rate behavior that we don't. Yeah, he knew that. The interesting thing is, Bill has become a class leader. Bill and some and these other guys fell by the wayside. Some of these guys were real snotty and snobbish. He thought Bill was beneath them. And Bill has surpassed them now in that society at the school, and become a real leader. I think that's great. But my point is, in other words, you give a kid a moral lecture at a point like that, he's not going to listen to you. Because why? Because you already listen. high schoolers, teenagers don't, here, let me just summarize this. Teenagers don't like moral lectures for the simple reason that they already know what's right and what's wrong. They're not stupid. They know exactly what's right and what's wrong in most cases. At least they've been raised in our homes. But what they need to, where they need reinforcement is, am I going to do what's quality, or am I going to do what's true? Well, you can build on, but to be able to talk to them like that, you have to build this foundation. You are special. And I find this, let me tell you this, you give a kid credit ahead of time for being something great, he'll bust a gut to be great. You know, if you've already given him credit for it, he'll really work to prove that you weren't wrong. But if you put a kid down, he'll work to show you're right there, too.
By giving him his special thing, and giving him credit ahead of time, they won't like their parents expect too much of him.
Well, that's a danger. You have to sometimes. The danger of it is sometimes the kids expect too much of themselves, depending on their personality. Whether that kid hangs loose or not. Now, Aaron is a hang loose kind of guy, you know, and he has high expectations of himself, but he doesn't. He kind of hangs. Now, Adam, my youngest, he's hard too. I had to really get on him recently. He's too hard on himself. He'll set a goal for himself. And if he doesn't make it, then he just climbs all over himself and just really puts himself down. And usually he makes his goal, but if he doesn't, the kids fail. So you have to make, and so you didn't, that is a danger, David. You have to watch him on that. But let me tell you this, kids, if you look what it says, I say in the syllabus, this makes room for failing without becoming a failure. Every kid fails. My kids fail. We fail, do we not? We all walk up to the plate just sure we're going to hit a home run and we strike out. But there's a difference between a kid failing and a kid becoming a failure. And there are a lot of kids who are in the fifth and sixth grade who already look at themselves as failures. But you see, if they have this idea that I'm talking about, it gives them room. You cut slack for a kid. So when he fails, you say, okay, you failed. That doesn't mean you're a failure. You'll win next time. No, you don't. If you don't make it, you don't make it. The kids, but it does create high expectations. You know, it's a delicate balance. I recall when Leslie was going out for to be a cheerleader in junior high school. Well, listen, she was determined. I never saw a kid work so hard. She had this fence out back, and she stood that fence by the hour and jumped. And when her feet were blistered, she jumped. I remember her. She would jump. Her feet would blister, and she would keep. She would put stuff on them and keep jumping. Wore the grass off. You know, and she made it. And she didn't. You know, she was determined. She said, "Remember that, Leslie? And I remember that when she made it, came back from making cheerleading. Then she made cheerleading all through high school too. But that first time, she made it simply because she was determined. And I never saw a kid work so hard for something, just absolutely going to do it. Now, but sometimes they don't make it. You know, they'll work for something, and often our kids don't. You see what I'm saying? But they don't just, when failures come along, you determine by your early training with your children whether these failures are going to ruin them or make failures of them, or whether they're going to brush them off and go on. Yeah, that's the price you pay. Yet, I don't really know. I don't have a good answer. I know what you're talking about, but I don't have a good answer. Because what happens if you get a kid who's never been built up, and they find an adult they respect who builds them up, they just cling. They'll just cling to them.
It's kind of like Bill. When I was at one park for a while, you know, he had Adam, and that's one thing that as a youth minister, when you're trying to do the same thing that Adam did.
Aaron, you mean? Yeah. Aaron. Yeah. Yeah, it's tough. You've used up all your energy. But I don't really have a good answer for you. Well, we come now to discipline. This is controversial. I list here the divine mandate. You can look at the scriptures here. Hebrews 12, 7 and 8 says, God has no children he does not discipline. And in the book of Proverbs 22, chapter 22, 23, 29, it's the divine man that we are to discipline our child. He'll not die. Discipline him. Now, what are the principles underlying discipline? Today, this is a bad word. It's interesting. Remember Dobson's book, Dare to Discipline? I thought the most significant thing about that book was the title. Why would you have to dare to discipline? Like, you know, we're going to be courageous, we're going to break precedent, we're going to plow new ground, we're going to do something unheard of, we're going to take our courage in our hand and dare to discipline. I can imagine my dad, somebody suggesting that to my father when I was growing up. Would you dare discipline your son? To him, it was not a dare, it was very ordinary. It was not an act of courage, it was not anything innovative, you know. It sort of came with the territory. It's part of his job. My dad never dared to discipline me. He just did it. You see what I'm saying? The idea that in our culture, you would have to operate on a dare to discipline. I'm going to teach you right now that I believe in strong discipline. Now, we're going to talk at this hour very quickly about discipline. First of all, parental unity at all costs. Long-term security outvotes short-term justice. If you're going to be a disciplinarian, mother and father must agree. You won't always agree perfectly, but kids, that's not fair. You always take her side. Yes, exactly right. You understand? Kids can live with short-term injustices. They cannot live without long-term security. Second, the purpose of discipline is not punishment. Did you hear that? One of the most important things I'm going to say. The purpose of discipline is not punishment. The purpose of discipline is self-discipline. That is, we teach our children to do what must be done, to do what is right, whether they feel like doing it at the moment or not. We all suffer a lack of self-discipline, do we not? I don't think anybody in this room would say, boy, I'm just as self-disciplined as I need to be. I would not say that. And I'm more disciplined than some of you, I know, because I've been at it longer. Self-discipline, but there has to be a measure of self. Every year at this school, I see this, and I weep over it. I see kids come in every year who are here because they want to be here. They planned on being here. They want to succeed, and they have the ability to succeed, and they don't make it. Why? Not because they can't do the work, but when the time comes, when they have to do that reading or start that term paper or study for that exam, and somebody's out throwing the frisbee or they're going to go to Pizza Hut or there's something else to do, at the short-term basis, they cannot make themselves do what they really want to do. Down deep, they really want to do it. But at that moment, they don't have the discipline. Self-discipline washes more kids out of Florida Christian. You know, we lose over half our students. And self-discipline washes more kids out than any other thing, in my opinion. The lack of self-discipline. You understand that? That is, they're good kids. They want to make it. And some of them, it takes them a while. I like our restricted program. I see students. It takes them a while to learn self-discipline. And a lot of students do a very good job of it. But listen to me. If your child has no self-discipline, that's your fault. You need to teach it. What does discipline do? You make a child. Here's a child. A toddler. Pick up your toys and put them away. It's time to go to bed. Does the child want to put up their toys and go to bed? No. But they have to do what they don't want to do. And they learn. This becomes a part of their life. Listen, if you don't ever learn to say no to... Remember that reading I gave you, what saying no to a child means in the syllabus? That's very important. That's very important material. And that comes from the secular world. The motive of this, the purpose of discipline is self-discipline. The motive of discipline is love. The theme is, because I love you, you must obey me. Or, and this ties in with what I talk about, you are special. I love you too much to let you grow up to be a jerk. And I tell my kids that. I mean, when I spank them. I have never spanked a child because they're bad. I spank a child because they're good. If they're bad and they act bad, then they're being normal. I remember one time I spanked Adam. He was growing up. And I always believed that Adam was my philosopher, so I could get in the abstract with him. I'd spank him. He was about five. And I forget what he had done. And he was standing there, you know. And so I said, Adam, you know why I spanked you? He's standing there, you know, thinking it over. He's the intellectual. And I said, let me ask you something, Adam. I said, did you ever see me spank the kids, the boys around the corner? He thought. He said, no, could never remember me doing that. And I'd like to, but I never did. I said, now why do I spank you and not them? He never thought about it that way before. I believe in giving the big picture. I said, the reason is that you're mine. And there isn't anything more important in this world to me than what you become. And I just love you too much that you grow up to be a jerk. You're not a bad boy, you're a good boy. If you were a bad boy, it wouldn't make a difference how you act. But you're not bad, you're good, and you're quality. And because you're a good boy and you're a quality kid, what you just did was unacceptable. It all depends on how you put it. You can discipline a kid and build him up, or you can discipline and put him down. You understand? You can build or destroy. And the decision is not whether you spank or not. The decision is how you put it. What do you say? What are you teaching the kid? And I did that to teenagers. Listen, I've manhandled teenage boys. I grab a teenage boy by the collar, back him up against the wall, and say, look, you think I've gone into the jerk business? You really think I'm raising trash? You want to be that way? You know, and I just really was. I said, you are not third-rate goods. You are quality, and I'm going to see you act that way. And boy, you know, you shot at him and put him down. I mean, I've shot at him and really scared the liver out of him. Why? Because your quality, and were you going to act any other way? Is that making sense to you? The purpose is, I love you. Because I love you, you must obey me. I love you too much to let you grow up. Listen to me. I can imagine a parent, especially a father, his is the primary responsibility, loving a son or a daughter so little that they let them grow up to be trash. Just one more piece of trash out there in society. There's enough trash out there. We don't need any more. You know what? Act trashy, talk trashy, think trashy. Who hates their children that much to let them grow up to be trashy just because they're too weak-minded to discipline them? Listen, one of the reasons a lot of parents don't discipline is they have no self-discipline themselves. A man or woman who cannot discipline themselves aren't going to discipline children. Okay. We start with the concept of absolute authority versus delegated authority. You understand those different concepts? Delegated authority says, I obey whatever rules I agree with or I help to make. Absolute authority says, you obey because it's built into the system. You see, Jesus is the authority of Jesus over the church absolute or delegated? It's absolute. Jesus did not become Lord of the church because we held an election. Now, if we had an election, we would vote him Lord of the church, but we didn't. The authority of God is not delegated. It's absolute. It's built in. It's intrinsic. Why do we obey God? Because God is God and we are not. Whether we understand, appreciate, or agree with what he tells us to do has nothing to do with it. And authority in the home must be based on absolute authority. Why do I have to obey you, Father? Because I'm Father, I'm the Daddy, and you're not. And I've told my kids that. Now, should we explain our rules? Yes, when and if. But it's a matter of choice. I mean, I usually explain my reasons, almost always do, but it's because I choose to. But if I don't choose to, you've got to obey me anyway. Why? I have the responsibility, therefore I have the authority. And, you see, we have to make our kids act in a certain way before they're old enough to understand why they have to act that way. And Spock and that, you know, some of those people said, you know, a child should never be made to do anything he doesn't understand. That's baloney. If you wait till a child's old enough to learn why he has to obey, he's already spoiled rotten before you're starting 3 years late. You understand that? So they learn the concept of absolute authority. And you can start that on the way home from the hospital. Look, kid, welcome to the house. Welcome to our house. We're glad you're here. Now, I'm Daddy and you're not. Everything, what I say goes. By the way, kids understand this perfectly. Kids understand. Now, are there democratic principles? The home is not a democracy. The home is a benevolent a monarchy. And sometimes, as I've said before, you will have elections. You will consult if you choose to. Listen, children, let me tell you this. Children, I'll teach a basic principle here. Modern humanists say that children need to be free. I agree. I think children should be free. Do you know when children feel free? Children feel free when somebody else is in charge. Children feel free in a context of control. You take away the context of control, children may be able to do what they want to do at the moment, but they do not feel free. Free, understand? Freedom to a child is have daddy and mommy in control. They're in charge. I'm safe. Here's the boundaries, and now I'm free. But you take away, listen, children who have no boundaries are not happy children. They are not free. A child, understand? A child who does pretty much what it wants to do, when it wants to do it, the way it wants to do it, and as long as it wants to do it, is not a free child. It is a bound child. Well, okay. Here's the principle. What you permit, you teach. No uncontrolled behavior permitted. If you would not sit down and teach a child to act a certain way, do not permit them to act a certain way. What you permit, you teach. What is uncontrolled behavior? Tantrums. What's a tantrum? What's a tantrum? A tantrum is a child cussing you. He just hasn't learned the words yet. When he gets old enough to learn the words, he'll use them. We had a rule at our house. Every child gets one tantrum per life.
Per life.
Nobody can throw a tantrum more than once except me, and I know how. And what do you do when a child tries to throw a tantrum? You throw a bigger one. I mean, you really let them have it. Scare the liver out. They say, boy, that's what it brings about. I mean, you raise your voice and grab them, and you can really get a child's attention. Thump them on the head. I mean, that doesn't kill them. It makes them mad. Oh, yeah. I thump Leslie. Listen, there's a reaction. Poor Leslie. About 2-3 months ago, she was mouthing off at the house, and as a reaction, I thumped her on the head. She said, "Daddy, I'm too old for that," and she's right. I shouldn't have done it. But it's just a reaction before I catch myself. You know, suck it in, kid. And and you thump on. Oh, listen, our kids. We've never had a kid in our house throw two tantrums. Each got one, and they decided it wasn't worth it. See what the experts say is, listen, the experts say, children throw a tantrum, what you do is you put them in a room by themselves, close the door, and say, well, when you can act in a civilized way, you can come out. You don't let them give them the attention. That is not how you handle a tantrum. Listen, the kid is asking it, is trying to settle something. I'll talk about it later. The kid is raising an issue. The issue is security, and all you've done is change the subject. Or you get a child who has something he's not supposed to have. You know he's not supposed to have it. So you'll get one of his toys and trade. Let's trade. You know it's good as well he's not supposed to have it. No, what you're doing is you're changing the subject, don't you? What he wants to know is, am I safe? Okay, we'll talk about that later. He's raising an issue of security. Is he in his own freedom within the boundaries? And you're changing. Let me tell you. You put him in a room, you know, let him cry it out. Next time, you do the same thing. You keep changing the subject and they'll keep raising the issue. They're trying to get an answer. Is that understand? They don't need you going around it. Listen, if a kid asks for a fight, he deserves one. Make sure he gets it. But make sure you win. Now, pouting is uncontrollable here. Pouting, often the kid, if he's afraid to throw a tantrum, he'll pout. A pout and a tantrum are exactly the same thing. One is active and one is passive. No pouting, that's a rule. No whining. Oh, I tell you, I cannot stand a kid who whines. We've never allowed a whining. You know what a whining kid is? A whining kid ends up getting abused, or should be. Rule at our house is either say it or don't say it, but you don't whine. I mean, you want to get thumped on the head, you whine. I'm serious. Any of you come to my house, I don't care if you're a college student, you start whining, I'll thump you on the head. That's just the rule at our house. The dog whines. The dog gets kicked. Not really. We don't have a dog anymore. One reason I'm... you know what whining is? I don't have to tell you what whining is. Whining is very destructive behavior. And mad crying. You know what mad crying is? It's opposed to when the kids, they're not hurt, they're mad. And it sounds different. Right, parents? I mean, you can tell the difference anywhere. The kid's really crying because they're hurt. The kid's hurting, you got a right to cry. If the kid's mad, he's just cussing you. He doesn't know the words yet. He's just, wow. That's enough.
Give him something to cry
about. That's right. Exactly. If you're going to cry, we're going to see that you use your time well. We're going to make it.
But you've got to admit, that's a really dumb question.
What?
Do you want something to really cry about? Yeah, Dad. Please.
Now, here's, I'm talking about spanking. Listen to me. The principle is, as in the physical realm, a small pain warns of and protects from a larger pain, even from death. Do you get that? Why kid such a hot stove? He learns not to avoid fire. Small pain protects a child. I've already talked about this, though, from a larger pain. That's the principle. Now listen to me. There is a difference between discipline and cruelty. You do not injure children. You understand? We know the difference. God has provided a wonderful territory, the buns, which you can make a loud noise and a lot of sting and do no damage, whatever. Sometimes you have to pull down the diaper to do it. But that's okay. Look at this. The early decrease in the need for physical punishment. Listen to me. I believe in corporal punishment. But by the time a child is 5 or 6 years old, you're pretty much done spanking. I cannot remember the last time I spanked a child. If you spank efficiently, you spank seldom. What is efficient spanking? Number one, if you say you're going to do it, you do it. And you don't mess around when you do it. Understand? And if they know you're going to, and if they know it's a spanking, it really is a spanking, you almost never have to spank. You understand? I'm not talking about child abuse. I'm talking about it's those who don't spank well who are abusing children, swatting at them, beating on them, even kicking them. You got that? By the time a child is 5 or 6 years old, you've got to be pretty much done spanking. When my children got past that age, if I spanked them once every a year, once every 6 months, wasn't that? It's very seldom. I can remember this. My wife, you know, kids get ragged. You know, they have a behavior we call ragged behavior. They're not really bad, they're not really good. They're getting kind of a surly attitude. They're challenging you, but they're not really stepping over the boundary. This happened a number of times when our children were little. We have an apple tree outside our house up in Ohio. And boy, the apple switches really, you know. And we have these kids, a house full of kids. And Linda would say to me, Roger, the kids are starting to get, they're starting to push me. They're starting to get toward the edge. You understand? There's a minor rebellion brewing. They're just not quite. But it's not, but it's not, you know, nothing you can put your finger. So I've done this a number of times. I'd go out back and I'd cut, make a big thing of it, make sure they can see me. You know, I'd cut the switch and I'd just test it, make sure it had a nice swing to it. And I'd put it on top of the refrigerator and let the end of it hang over. And I'd say real loud, well, I'm gonna put this up here because apparently I'm going to need it soon. And I can't tell you how many switches laid up there in dry rotting. Those kids, you know, they look for and see that, you know. Not until you just restore order. Listen, one time I did try that. I had to take it down and use it, and it broke. It was rotten. And I had to go out and get another one. But I almost never used those things. You know why? They knew I would. And you understand? If you will spank, and you do it, you seldom have to.
Did you ever... go with the principle of sending the child out to those who are jury?
No, that's cruel and unusual punishment.
A lot of parents do that.
Two things you don't do to small children. You don't make them cut their own switch. Second, you don't delay punishment. You don't say, I'm going to get back to you in an hour. That's cruel and unusual punishment. Only under... And a mother should never do that. Listen, mothers, if your kids act up, you take care of it. Don't, unless it's an extreme case, don't say, when your father gets home, he's going to spank you. That is cruel and unusual. That is very hard on a small child. It is not fair.
If you have a small child, 3 or 4 years old, in a store... out in public or something.
We'll talk about that. Okay. You understand? Listen, children have a sense of guilt when they've done wrong. Children think in terms of short periods of time. They need it resolved and over with. If they've done something, if you need to discipline them, you take care of it, then you forget it, and life goes on. You don't keep bringing it up, and you don't hang it. You don't make it a long-term thing. Just don't do that. Now look at this. Spanking should be reserved. Look at this very important principle. Spanking should be reserved for open rebellion. Other forms of punishment should be used for childish irresponsibility. Dobson emphasizes this, and he's right. What do you do? Understand, it's one thing for a kid to, in effect, say, I'm not going to do it. Let's see you make me. And some kids do that. But that's something different from a child who really intended to obey, but they had momentum. And they just couldn't make themselves. It just took a while. And some kids are like that. Now, Aaron was a good obeyer. Aaron would just... He could. Adam, he's kind of a strong little child. And Adam would get momentum. You tell him it's time to put your toys away, do something. He really meant to do it. But he, as Linda and I had a joke, he couldn't find the off button. You have a kid like that? He's not really, he just, once he gets his mind on it, he focuses. He's playing, he's really involved in it, and he's got momentum, and he really intends to obey you, you know? He really meant to do it, but he didn't look at you and say, I'm not going to do it. He's going to do it. He wants to do it. He's a good boy, but he just couldn't quite do it. What do you do? I developed a plan with him. I'd come in, I'd say, didn't I tell you to do this, put that away? Oh, yes, I said. Now you go sit in that chair, and you make a decision. Now, Adam, I'll be back in a few minutes, and I need to know what you're planning on, whether you're going to obey me or not. So we got a rule at our house, I'm going to tell you once. So I don't tell him again. I'm making him think it over. I said, now, I'll be back in a few minutes. You tell me whether you're going to obey me or not, then I'll know how to act. So he sits there, you know, he's thinking. I'll come back. Yes or no, you're going to obey me. Yes or no. He's sitting there thinking. I come back and I say, well, what'd you decide? I'm going to obey you. Good thinking, smart man. Oh, you're going to grow up to be a great man someday. I just really built it. Clear thinking, you know. And he goes and puts it away. I didn't tell him twice. He needed to be trained to think it over. He needed room. You understand? He didn't need to be spanked because he wasn't bad. He just had momentum. And kids are like that. But you can't ignore it. What do you do? Childish irresponsibility. They don't put a toy up, you put it away. Favorite toy, they will not, you know, if they're irresponsible. What do you do if a child spills something? You told the kid, this is real life, I'm not making this up. Well, you get the milk and you put it in front of the plate. Why? If you put it here, what do they do? They knock it over. And you tell them to put it up here. But they forget, children forget. They didn't say, I don't care what you say, I'm going to put it here. No, they took a couple of drinks and they forgot and they put it here and they knock it over. What do? You don't smack a child for that. You don't humiliate a child. Nothing makes up for humiliating a child in public. Leslie was our spiller next to me. She inherited from me. And I remember one time we had a dinner and we had guests. Tell us all that. We had guests. And we were talking, and they were at the table. I think it was their grandma and grand. I don't know who it was. But you know, children get embarrassed easily. And Leslie, she was just a small child. She knocked over her milk, and I caught my eye. I could say, and she just, you could see her dying inside. What do? You get up and rare. I told you, you know, you really make a big nothing. And I made a point. I was like, come on. I didn't even stop my conversation. I was talking to a friend. I reached out and grabbed a couple of napkins, and I said, well, I'm glad you did that before I did. Or usually that's me. I went right on, it's like nothing had happened. And my wife got another glass of milk. Bless you, so grateful. She's sitting there. I can still see that look on her face. Why? She didn't need to be humiliated. No. She didn't mean to knock it over. She didn't reach out some way. You don't do that to kids. You understand? So you make a difference. Now, if a child is completely careless, then you deal with it other ways. But you don't spank them for that. You spank them for rebellion. And you know the difference, don't you, with your kids? You can tell the difference. Now, yes.
Commercial
that
some
of
you little boy in
the
high chair.
Yeah.
Is
that strictly rebellion or?
That's stupidity on the parents' part. Parents use wheels.
It could. That's rebellion. A kid just picks it up. You know, they know. It's one thing for.
But for a parent to buy the kid a dish
that's
made
well,
looks like airplane.
That's not real. That's not real. That's not realistic. Listen, the absolute, listen to this. The absolute necessity of consistency in punishment. And we're not, we need to work consistent. See, here's what a lot of parents do. When does a child get spanked? When the parent is mad. When the temperature goes up, they turn a certain color of red, then the kid gets spanked. No, it means it needs to be consistency in punishment. Well, it depends. But you can be no. You mean to be reasonable. Some children go through stages where they don't want to eat, and it depends on the amount. But if they don't want to eat just because they don't want to eat and they haven't eaten anything, then you say, "What's time to eat?" Something on the head if you have to. You eat it. This thing of, well, we'll put it away. You can come back whenever you feel like it. That's not. It's not healthy for a kid anyway. Well, that's not healthy for a child.
What about if you like to hold a snack?
If what?
You don't eat a snack. Usually they have eat.
With hold a snack, make them eat.
She won't eat, but if you tell her, you don't eat, you get a snack, she'll eat that too.
Well, children, when they're growing up, should not have snacks anyway between meals. Sweets, that's not healthy for children. That ought not to be a regular part of their life. Some kids, you know, they get candy every day and a regular snack. That's not smart. One thing, you get your first big dentist bill, you'll put a stop to that. They'll not do that anyway in the first place. Eat at mealtime. Now, do you have special treats for special times? I'm talking about a regular. Some kids regularly know they get Twinkies and stuff every day. That's just not healthy. Not good for kids. Kids need to learn to eat what we fix for them. We know better. They'll learn that, basically. Now, there'll be times your kid doesn't feel good, or you have something he doesn't like. We'll talk about that later. But just stubborn, no, you eat. Listen, let me tell you something. There's a lot to be said for terror. Not much terror, just a little bit of terror. And which is control. It's a healthy amount. You eat it. And they know what they have to or not. They learn. Children learn who's in charge. They know. You see, let me talk about it. In any situation where there's a clash of the wills, whoever's will prevails, that's who's the head of the house. Now, you don't want to be ridiculous about it. There are times when you need to back off. But that common sense dictates that. Look at this. The absolute necessity of consistency. Forms of punishment for older children. Older children should be spanked only in extreme circumstances. But I never tell them that. I think the oldest I ever spanked a kid was 13. But I would do it. I would do it over if I had to. And I can. But that's not how you... Look at it. With older children, grounding, denial of privilege, monetary fines, but do not nag. Children, it is not fair to nag children. Do not nag your kids. Especially older kids. You want to turn them off, you nag them. Nag, nag, nag. Whine, whine, whine. It's not worth it.
How do you nag? We talk about, I don't understand.
Nagging a child. You get a kid who's got to behave. Some kids are naturally sloppy. Some kids are naturally neat. You get a kid who's naturally sloppy, what are you going to do? Nag them, tell them the same thing every day until they can, here comes the speech again. And let me tell you something. Here's a principle of priority. Listen to me. There's a proper balance between order and disorder. No home, no system is perfectly symmetrical, perfectly orderly. That is, you can teach your kids to pick up and put away, but they're not going to do it perfectly. How far do you go? Well, you start with order in the home. I've seen homes run like in a military fashion. But there's a principle, and my wife has taught me this, and she's right about it, where it's not worth it, we call it fishing with a golden hook. Well, you know, that's because of the ancient Romans, I call it that. You know what fishing with a golden hook is? They say you never go fishing with a golden hook because what you stand to lose is not worth what you stand to gain. All you're going to gain is a fish, but you're going to lose a golden hook. Now, some parents go fishing with a golden hook. That is, so children have certain behavioral patterns, and within limits, they're going to act that way. How far do you? Teach you what I'm trying to make. You get it. You get kids. You get a couple of teenage boys. If you're going to have their room always picked up when they leave, all the drawers closed, every bed made, if you're going to have that, you're going to have to stay on top of them every minute. Most teenage boys. Why? They're in a rush. They don't get their contact lens in. They run. What are you going to do? You're going to destroy your relationship with them? No. You make them clean it up every so often. But there are more, as my wife says, there are more important things. And some parents are so busy enforcing, who think they're disciplinarians, are so busy enforcing the rules that they lose their kids. Listen, the rules are, it's the old principle, is the Sabbath for man or the man for the Sabbath. And sometimes it's not worth it, you understand? If you're going to destroy your relationship with your kid, there are other important things to be talked about. Okay, I can put up with a messy room once in a while, as long as I have kids have a good attitude and we have time to deal with some of the important things. There are more important things than having the house, the room picked up every morning. You understand what I'm saying? And you need to learn that, to know where to draw the line.
Dr. Chandler, do you believe in giving a kid an allowance?
No, I don't. Well, allowance, not, I mean, say that, that's not true. I believe in giving a kid an allowance, but I don't believe in paying them for good grades or for work around the house. You work around the house because you're a part of the family. That's, we all work. I don't believe in paying for good grades because first time my kid asked me that, DeAngela asked me that. She had a friend that got $5 every time she got in. She was kind of halfway kidding. She said, and every one of our kids has got this speech. She said, well, boy, if I got $5 for every, almost 20.